Hello, everyone. This is Angela Glosser, your Good News on Demand volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. Today I will read a few articles. The first one is from the New York Times, published today, November 20, in the arts section. It's called The Artist, the Gallerist, and Their Liver by Ray Mark Rinaldi. Far from the dizzying auctions, splashy galas, and angling dealers, a precious gift sheds light on a gentler way the art world works. Jennifer Duran was in desperate place on the evening of February 23, 2023, when she quietly interrupted a celebration that Robichon Gallery was throwing for its 45th anniversary and summoned the artist in attendance to join her in a back room. There, Duran, who owns the gallery, let out a secret. She was dying. She told the artists, some of whom had been on her roster for many years. Her liver was failing. A transplant was the only option. She needed to find a donor, and members of her family were not a match. Duran implored the artist to help spread the word and explained that a donor would have to give up only a portion of their organ for the procedure. She just needed one person to step up. Among the group was Derek Velasquez, an artist who had signed on with the gallery in 2010 when he was just out of grad school. I just remember kind of like staring off into the distance, he said. I was thinking how difficult it must have been to ask for something like this. Velasquez was recalling the moment during a recent interview, a few hours before his latest exhibit opened at Robichon. The show, which runs through December 31, is his first at the gallery since an operation in July 2023, when doctors removed 58% of his liver and gave it to Duran, thereby saving her life. He is doing fine now, he said. His liver has grown back to 90% of what it was before the procedure. The thin vertical scar on his abdomen is fading. Duran, 70, has had a rough recovery. She was in the hospital for nearly 4 weeks after the surgery and suffered 6 spontaneous back fractures as osteoporosis developed in her weakened body. But her new liver is functioning well now. She has returned to work nearly full-time and was healthy enough to oversee the installation of Velasquez's show. A lot of transplant patients are really feeling great after a few months, she said, but that was not my case. She called the transplant one of the two miracles that have kept her alive over decades of battling primary biliary cholangitis, an autoimmune disease that damages the liver slowly. The first miracle was being told that I had 6 months to live at age 45, but that there was a new experimental drug available that took 6 months to work. And it did, she said. But she was always waiting for the other shoe to drop, she said, knowing the medicine was not going to be effective for her whole life. But then I had my other miracle, she said, which was Derek. Velasquez, 42, said he signed up quickly on a list of potential donors and immediately began exercising and cutting out alcohol and processed foods like hot dogs, one of his favorite meals, just in case. He also thought deeply, he said, and at times questioned his decision, especially as he went through the medical tests and psychological counseling required to determine if he was a suitable candidate. Doctors and social workers at Anschutz Medical Campus in nearby Aurora, Colorado, where the operation took place, want to know a donor's motive and if they feel pressured or are being compensated. Most transplanted livers at the hospital come from patients who check a box on their driver's license and then die suddenly. Their recipients never knew them. But voluntary donations, often from relatives or friends, can come with complications. We want to make sure the donor is not being coerced somehow, said Dr. Trevor L. Nydum, the interim chief of transplant surgery at Anschutz. That is rare, but it does happen, and it is something we want to be careful with. The medical team also let Velasquez know he could back out until the very last minute, and that gave him about 4 weeks to contemplate the impending procedure. Friends and family weighed in with different options, including his mother, who asked him to reconsider. "You're as healthy as you can be, and you're going to put yourself at the risk of dying at some point," he said. "Why?" "And for whom?" he questioned. Duran was his gallerist, but both acknowledged in recent interviews that while there was an easy rapport between them and years of trust, they never considered each other close friends before the procedure. Instead, both talked about a bond that they believe develops between many artists and their gallerists as they carry out their work. They may not go out for cocktails or watch sports together, but conversations between the two parties can get intimate. They know quite a bit about each other's finances, and they discuss the ideas that inspire art making and define careers for artists and gallerists alike. He would talk to her about wanting to be both a good artist and a good citizen, and about his side projects that went beyond their business interests. She supported his civic-minded work, which included serving on the Denver Arts Commission and mentoring younger artists. Over the years, he opened two small and informal galleries to introduce emerging talent to the community, one in the basement of his home. Duran would show up at important exhibition openings. When Velasquez expressed anxiety about getting pigeonholed as a commercial artist, she encouraged him to make art beyond what she could easily sell at the gallery, art that delved into social themes like equity, the environment, and affordable housing. "I listened to him. He listened to me," Duran said. In turn, he said, she told of him about her own worries that Robichon may be perceived as a snooty coastal gallery. That moved to her stories about growing up and her family in Seattle, and how that formed her sense of who she is. It was all connected to work, but fell into the kind of chatter that happens between people who are actually friends. "Jennifer is good at talking about art and about actual life," Velasquez said. "I wouldn't have done this for anyone," he added, "but I would have done this for a lot of people." After so many years and so many openings that he attended and the fellow artists he got to know there, Robichon was his second home. Velasquez went there for the first time in November 2008. He had just moved to Denver after graduating with an MFA from Ohio State University. He wandered into Robichon and was mesmerized, he said. Not only did the gallery represent top Colorado artists, it was also the regional dealer for some of the international art stars he studied at school. Frank Stella and Kiki Smith were on Robichon's roster. So was Anne Hamilton, who was showing the day he stopped by. 2 years later, Velasquez answered a call he found on Craigslist, inviting artists to submit work for a group show at another local gallery, Jim Robichon, Duran's husband and the co-owner of Robichon Gallery, was one of the jurors. Velasquez submitted a piece of work in which he cut sheets of colored vinyl into hundreds of strips, each about 1 inch wide and 30 inches long, and draped them on top of one another over a piece of wood. The work was installed so that it hung flat against the wall, and viewers could see the layers of thin vinyl strips from their sides, in the way growth rings are visible on a crosscut of a tree trunk. It was an update of geometric abstraction using new materials and fresh angles. "We saw the merit in that and the innovation," Duran said, and he was responsive to pursuing additional works like that. That morphed into an enduring business partnership at Robichon. The vinyl pieces have become a signature for Velasquez, and the gallery has sold many. There are several pieces in the new show, one priced at $27,000. Velasquez is also in good company at Robichon, which is concurrently hosting solo shows in different rooms by Anne Hamilton and Judy Plouffe. Velasquez exhibits nationally. In 2017, he received a painters and sculptors grant from the Joan Mitchell Foundation, and his art making has evolved to include many different styles. The new show also includes a series of small oil paintings and cast resin sculptures, along with work in stained glass, a craft he has recently mastered. It sounds weird to say, but I love that gallery and what it is, Velasquez said. Looking back, he said, it was that wider affection that motivated him. He knew his dealer might die without the help. What would that mean for the gallery that had nurtured his career and that of many others? If she wasn't alive, I don't think the gallery would continue to exist, he said. It would, according to Duran, who said she was overwhelmed, not just by Velasquez's generosity, but also by support from other artists, gallerists, and curators who stepped in to keep things going during her illness. She is emboldened, she said. As for the artist and the dealer, that bond they spoke about has changed. They are much closer, though she's still his gallerist, he said. There's a personal relationship, but there remains business. She's like an aunt now, maybe, he said. You see your aunt maybe two, three, four times a year. You go to their house and you know them. But they're not like your parents or your close friends. That's kind of the way we're talking now. Now, speaking of friends, I found an article in The Atlantic called A Ridiculous Perfect Way to Make Friends. Group fitness classes aren't just about exercise, by Michaela Jameson. When I was teaching indoor cycling every week, an unexpected benefit of the gig was free ice cream. One of the class regulars had an ice cream machine at home and sometimes brought samples for me to try in flavors such as pumpkin and pistachio. I think he did this not only because he was a nice person, but also because in class I was the nicest version of myself, warm, welcoming, and encouraging to the point of profound corniness, despite my usual caustic tendencies. I noticed this friendliness in others too. Two people who met in my class started dating. Strangers who became friends there went out for post-workout coffees. Two of the other class regulars invited me to go skiing with them. Many of the good friends I have at age 35 are people I met in exercise classes I attended regularly. These experiences have convinced me that group fitness classes are the best place to make friends as an adult, an idea supported by research that suggests that the glow of exercise's feel-good chemicals has interpersonal benefits. Once, countless friendships were born in what the sociologist Ray Oldenburg called third places, physical spaces that aren't a home or a workplace, don't charge much for entry, and exist in large part to foster conversation. Over the past several decades, though, and especially as a result of the pandemic, third places such as bars and cafes have begun playing a much smaller role in social life, depriving American adults of opportunities for chance encounters that can lead to friendships. Perhaps that's partly why Americans rank improving their relationships among their top New Year's resolutions. Group fitness classes don't exactly fit the definition of a third place. They cost money, and the primary activities within there are sweating, grunting, and skipping a few reps when the instructor isn't looking. But they fulfill many conditions that social psychology research has repeatedly shown to help forge meaningful connections between strangers. Proximity, being in the same place, ritual at the same time over and over, accumulation for many hours, and shared experiences or interests because you do and like the same things. Sussing out shared interests can be horribly awkward when you meet someone new at work or even at a party. Group fitness classes make it a little easier. Stephanie Roth Goldberg, an athletic psychotherapist in New York, told me, automatically, when you walk into a fitness class, you likely are sharing the idea that we like to exercise or we like to do this particular kind of exercise, she said. It breaks the ice differently than standing in a bar or at someone's house. Of course, breaking the ice still requires someone to say something, which, if you're sweaty and huffing, is frankly terrifying. Whether I'm an instructor or a classmate, one simple tactic has never failed me. I simply walk up to someone after class and say, "Hey, good job." Proximity, ritual, and accumulation all require a certain amount of time, which can be hard to come by in a country that requires and rewards long hours at work. But you're already making time for exercise class, and it provides those conditions. Benefiting from them mostly requires acknowledging that you've already set yourself up for friendship. Danielle Friedman, a journalist and the author of Let's Get Physical, told me that breaking through what she calls the social code of anonymity is key to making friends. If you've been going to the same class for a while and start seeing the same people, don't pretend like you've never interacted before, she said. That kind of friendliness requires adopting the cliched feel-goodery inherent in many group fitness classes. In my spin classes, I'd cringe whenever I caught myself doling out motivational platitudes, mostly, "We're all in this together," because I needed the reminder too as I tried to talk and spin at the same time. Inevitably, though, someone would say, "Whew," in response and re-energize the whole room. I'd load up my playlist with high-tempo remixes of early aughts, top 40 hits, and catch people singing along. One of my favorite instructors in a class I attended regularly instituted Fun Friday, when we'd warm up by doing silly little relay races or grade school-style games. My blood ran cold the first time she told us to partner up for this cheese fest, but I had a blast. Everyone did. In a world that prizes ironic detachment, embracing such earnest silliness can feel deeply uncomfortable. But, and you might as well get used to hearing this kind of phrase now, if you're going to start attending classes, you just have to push through. When you're sweating, feeling a little out of control of your physical self, whooping and yelling, there's a vulnerability, Friedman said. If you buy in, then you've shared something. There aren't that many contexts as adults where you have that opportunity to be vulnerable together. A room full of grown adults flailing, shouting, and running miles without ever going anywhere is a fundamentally ridiculous prospect. Ridiculous things, however, play a crucial role in connecting with others. They make us laugh. Studies show that laughing with others facilitates social connection by helping us feel that we have more in common. The happy hormones released during exercise, endorphins, dopamine, and serotonin, are also associated with bonding. In particular, exercising in sync with others promotes close relationships. Even if you don't find your next best friend at Zumba, getting into a fitness habit of some kind might help you meet people and make friends in other spaces. The more that people can step out of their comfort zone in one setting, the less intimidating it is to do in other settings, Goldberg said. Perhaps you'll even become the version of yourself who inspires people to bring you homemade ice cream. Win-win. Michaela Jameson is the author of the health and culture newsletter, Body Type, on Substack. She's working on her first book on exercise and body image. She's also worked as a group fitness instructor and trained as a competitive powerlifter. And here's another article from Apple News, from NPR. Scientists find a 35,000-year-old saber-toothed kitten in the Siberian permafrost. The kitten, which was found in Russia's northeastern Sakha Republic, still had fur and whiskers when it was discovered by Mansi Khurana in November 16, 2024. Scientists noted that the kitten's unusual muzzle shape in their paper. The kitten had small ears and a large mouth opening. An ancient cat was found almost perfectly preserved in Siberia's permafrost. Researchers found the mummy of a 35,000-year-old saber-toothed cub in what is now Russia's northeastern Sakha Republic, also known as Yakutia, in 2020. A study published this past week in the journal Scientific Reports shows that the cat was just 3 weeks old when it died, but its cause of death is unknown. The kitten still had its whiskers and claws attached when it was pulled out of the permafrost and was covered in a coat of short, thick, soft, dark brown fur. Its hair was about 20 to 30 millimeters long, according to researchers. The remarkable preservation provided a unique opportunity for researchers to study the extinct animal. For the first time in the history of paleontology, the appearance of an extinct mammal that has no analogs in the modern fauna has been studied, the paper's authors write. Saber-toothed cats from the genus Homotherarium are known for their enormous canine teeth, which stuck out of their mouths and were used to kill and grab prey. It's estimated that the animals went extinct about 12,000 years ago at the end of the Pleistocene period, which is also known as the last ice age. Radiocarbon dating of the kitten's fur suggests that it had been buried for at least 35,000 years. It is the first time that scientists have been able to describe physical characteristics like the texture of the fur, muscle mass, and the shape of the muzzle for this species. Saber-toothed cat fossils have been found in the Americas, Africa, and Eurasia. When looking at the mummified cub, scientists found some interesting differences between the kitten and a modern lion cub, particularly in their paws. The saber-toothed kitten had wider paws, but no carpal pads. That's the wrist joint that helps modern-day felines absorb shock. As Live Science explained, scientists hypothesize that these adaptions helped as saber-toothed cat walk over thick snow with ease. The paper also noted that the cub had a massive neck region and an unusual muzzle shape. The kitten had small ears, but a massive mouth opening and elongated forelimbs. This is not the first time a well-preserved mammal has been discovered in Siberia. In August, gold miners in Siberia announced they had unearthed a woolly mammal that still had a horn attached to its body. 2 months earlier, scientists announced they had completed a necropsy on a completely mummified wolf, also from the last ice age, that was found in the Siberian permafrost. The cold and dry conditions of the region make it an ideal place to find intact fossils from ancient times. The dry air dehydrates the soft tissue of the animal, and the freezing cold creates a perfect time capsule for scientists to discover centuries later. Well, that's all for today, and I hope you enjoyed this as much as I enjoyed finding good news out there. This is Angela Glosser from Sun Sounds, Arizona. See you next time.